2012, February 15th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 29, The Children of Saturn. We're continuing our exploration of the solar system and where there's life in the solar system today. Yesterday, we saw a place where one would have not have thought to look for life in the classic way of saying, where do you have stable liquid water on the surface? The classic problem of how you look at Venus, Earth, and Mars. But what we found is a couple of exceptions to the basic rules we played for ourselves. Sunlight is not the whole story. There can be places where sunlight's not the only form of energy available to life. We see that on the Earth in the deep ocean vents. And so why should it be the rule everywhere in the solar system? But you do need liquid water. How do you get liquid water? Again, there's a provincial point of view that only looks at it in terms of surface water. But there are other places where you can have liquid water by having a combination of pressure, for example, from above, we usually get that on Earth by an atmosphere, and internal heat from below. We don't get that on the Earth because our heat is more important coming from the sun than internally. But on a place like Europa, you have a deep ice cap, which is pressing down upon the liquid water, or the water that makes up that ice cap, and you have heat from tidal heating coming up from below. And that combination, and a series of other evidences, seem to suggest there's liquid water beneath the ices of Europa. If you have liquid water, heat, organics, you have most of the basic prerequisites for life. Where else in the solar system do those circumstances occur? Or perhaps do circumstances like that on perhaps the prebiotic Earth occur? And that's what we're going to be asking today by looking at two of the children of the planet Saturn. Saturn has 61 moons. One of them's a giant moon. The rest of them are little small ice balls. Some of them are spherical. Some of them are irregular. But now we're getting into a place where the composition is mostly ice and rock. It's reminiscent of the outer two Galilean satellites of Jupiter, but we're going to find some surprises. In particular, Enceladus is one of these small ice ball moons. It's the brightest body in the solar system. It's covered with very fresh ice, has a very geologically young surface, and was recently discovered with the Cassini spacecraft to have spectacular ice fountains, actually capable of ejecting ice off of the weak gravity of this object. This makes it very interesting because we think there's a combination of tidal heating and radioactive decay on the interior of Enceladus, which is hinting once again at a possibility of a significant subsurface liquid water ocean below the ice caps of Enceladus. We have less clear idea of what's going on here, but there's been some recent work, which we'll be summarizing, that actually makes this now the second possibly promising place where to go looking for life elsewhere in our solar system after Europa. The other place where we're going to look is the most unique moon in the entire solar system, Titan. It's the only moon which has an atmosphere on it. It happens to be a good combination of how big it is and how cold it is out by Saturn that it actually has a heavy nitrogen methane atmosphere. It's able to hold on to it. It actually has about 1.6 atmospheres of pressure on its surface. However, it's a cold place. Water is not liquid on the surface of Titan. It's like sand. It's like rock. But methane, particularly liquid methane, plays the same role on Titan that water plays on the Earth. It exists in all three phases, vapor, solid, and liquid. And in fact, goes through a liquid-vapor phase combination, just like water goes through that. So there is methane weather on Titan. There are methane lakes. There are methane mudflats. There's methane river flows. This is a really crazy place. And the reason why we're going to concentrate on Titan is its conditions are probably prebiotic, even though it's very cold. So Enceladus might be the place we want to search for life as we understand it, but Titan is a good glimpse of a prebiotic world, and it's a place we're going to go back to and study in the future. That's where we're going today. We're going to look at these two interesting children of Saturn, which can inform us something about the nature of life on other worlds. Enceladus, which is a place of liquid water, and Titan, which may represent a truly alien environment in which we have some of the prerequisites, in this case a liquid solvent, which is not water, it's liquid methane. This is a gorgeous picture that was taken by the Cassini spacecraft. Cassini is on a very long orbit around Saturn. It's been there for many years now, and is continuing. Its mission is lasting much longer. It carried a lander probe, Huygens, which was dropped onto the surface of Titan, and Cassini has proceeded to orbit Saturn many times. It's a very long orbit that takes it far away and back down. It's plunged through the ring plane. has made close passes by many of the major moons by now, has a radar mapper for looking through the cloud decks of Titan, has very high-resolution cameras. A number of years ago, it took this really spectacular picture. This is a view which is impossible from the Earth because it's beyond Saturn from respect. The Sun is on the other side. The Sun is being eclipsed by Saturn in this picture. Saturn has a heavy atmosphere, so you're seeing light refracting around that atmosphere. The rings are made of tiny ice particles, which range in size basically from grains of sand up to boulders the size of a house, all made of pristine water ice. It's constantly grinding against the other pieces, which makes them bright and shiny. And you can see through them. There are multiple grooves. There's lane upon lane of these things. This is an absolutely spectacular view of the rings, plus the very, very faint outer E-ring of the planet. And a number of features looking back. We're looking back towards the solar system, but I want to call your attention to this little blip right there. That's the Earth. That's the Earth viewed from a billion kilometers away. Shows up as a little tiny blue dot. We're going to come back to this picture later on in the class, or in this course. But I just want to remind you is that part of what we're looking at is the contrast here. A very giant, gas giant world with a number of moons. And yet in viewing it, we always never lose sight of the fact one of the reasons we go to these places, we're interested in where we came from. And these studies of these are part of what inform us of that. Saturn has a very large moon system. The current count is 61 moons, although there's a number of candidates, which is going to probably push this up close to 70 moons here in a couple years. We're going to be interested in some of the moons. A lot of them are in close. They're actually down in really close towards the ring system. There's actually a couple of moons that are actually sliding inside the ring systems. That's what causes, in many ways, some of the interesting gaps. Some of them are fairly large. One moon in particular is of interest to us, is embedded in this faint, diffuse outer E-ring, as it's called. The rings of Saturn have the rather boring names E, B, C, D, E, and F. But Enceladus is living down in here. Tethys and Dione are fairly large moons. And then there's a very large moon system that extends, actually, in this particular scale, Titan's orbit is actually outside in the courtyard there by size. This is the largest moon, but it actually lives much further away. So there's a very, very large system of moons around the planet Saturn. Many more regular spherical moons than we saw around Jupiter. But it's Titan and Enceladus. All these others are really cool. There's some nifty stuff going on. But they have very ancient cratered surfaces. They're ice balls. There's some really interesting stuff going on in a lot of them. But Enceladus and Titan are the ones that are going to get our attention here today. So today's really lecture is, even though we use the title The Children of Saturn, this is really going to be a tale of two moons, one large, one small. Now, they're actually quite far away from each other, but the Cassini spacecraft was passing between Enceladus and the rings at the time it took this picture, looking back towards Titan and Enceladus in the distance. So this is not a composite. This is an actual photograph from the Cassini spacecraft. Cassini has, in the last few years, completely changed our view of the Saturn system. Start with Enceladus. Enceladus was really only viewed from a long distance by the passage of the Voyager spacecraft in the 1980s. It was only really with Cassini that we got a good close-up look at it. Enceladus had already made itself known because it was probably the brightest, shiniest surface in the entire solar system. It's bright, brilliant white. Old ice tends to accumulate crap, and that crap tends to make it dark. So when you see really fresh, shiny ice, you know you're dealing with fresh, recent ice. When we passed by, what in fact is confirmed is that the bright shininess is a sign of geological activity. The surface is cratered, but it's very lightly cratered. It's covered with these very, very bright, white, brilliant snow. In fact, the as we saw in a lecture a couple times ago, the albedo of Enceladus is close to 98.989%. It's about as shiny as you can possibly get without becoming purely specular reflective. What was interesting, though, is towards the southern hemisphere, and there's these grooves and bright grooves and cracks, not like Enceladus at all, not like Europa at all, but then there are these features here which ran sort of on long lines here. Now, these have been color enhanced, which is why they look kind of bluish. That's just simply the computer enhancing contrast to see them. These were referred to originally in the first distant images as tiger stripes. No one was really quite what sure they were. They seemed to be a little bit warmer than the surroundings, but no one really had a good idea what was going on. So we actually see tectonism on the surface of Enceladus. We see scarps and grooves, ridges. We see signs that the ice is kind of moving around a bit. So it's actually sort of this wrinkling appearance of scarps and grooves is important. It also has a very, very thin water vapor atmosphere. Very, very thin, tenuous. And there's fresh water ice. So that water vapor comes up, it sort of forms an atmosphere, and then it kind of snows out on the surface. Also, Enceladus is embedded deeply within the E-ring, which is made of fresh, bright, shiny ices. And it was thought that the E-ring was probably probably built by something having to do with Enceladus. And we'll see in a moment, it has a lot to do with Enceladus. So if we look really close up at the surface, you can see the craters, but you see how it looks like there's a layer of snow on top of them, although this is really ice. At this kinds of temperatures, this is a very, very cold place, 30, 40 degrees Kelvin. So the surface is really at the point where water ice is really like rock. And you could think of water ice grains on the surface of this like sand. There are, in fact, some higher resolution images that show ice boulders. You see real detailed terrains, but you see all this grooving across the surface. Some of this is cracking. Some of this is as things cool, they kind of pull apart. But you can see how the craters are kind of, they're covered over. They're not new, fresh craters for the most part. There are a few, and they're visible elsewhere. But even here, you see a very large crater, which has kind of been filled in. So this is a world which is geologically active. People were expecting a little bit of geologic activity because of the brightness of it, but the degree of geologic activity surprised everybody. So this was kind of the view we had up to relatively early in the Cassini mission of Enceladus was this bright kind of snowball world, very geologically young surface with very few craters, these cracks, these funky tiger stripes that no one quite understood. Now, I started the lecture with that picture of Saturn backlit by the sun, where you see the light scattering through. During the course of flying by the moon Enceladus, they took a shot looking back at Enceladus when Enceladus was eclipsing the sun. So Enceladus is between us and the sun, and so you have Enceladus backlit. One of the primary reasons for doing that is spacecraft navigation. You block the sun out so you lose the glare of the sun, then you take a deep image where you expose for a long time to get background stars, and you can still see the limb of the moon backlit by the sun, and you get the distance between the moon and those stars. You're basically doing celestial navigation. It's part of how you know where your spacecraft is when it's orbiting a planet a few billion kilometers away, and then you can make adjustments to its course. Remember, Cassini is constantly adjusting its course to fly by these things. You don't want errors coming in so that when you adjust your course, you run into a moon instead of flying past it. So when they took one of those navigation images looking back on Enceladus, they saw this. Here again are the background stars that they were trying to see. They're trailed a bit because of the motion of the spacecraft. Here's the limb of the planet, showing a very crescent Enceladus, but they saw these fountains. I was teaching astronomy 161 when this showed up on astronomy picture of the day, and I said, okay, whatever we're talking about this morning. This is cryovolcanism in action. These are water geysers, and the origin of these are the tiger stripes. The tiger stripes are right on top of these things, and they became very quickly named the fountains of Enceladus. We're seeing water ice streaming actively in real time off of this moon. That's what's building up the E-ring. This stuff basically is geysering off with sufficient speed. It escapes some of it falls back, some of it escapes from the gravity of Enceladus, and then goes into orbit around Saturn and builds up that faint, diffuse E-ring. There's some beautiful pictures, which I don't have time to show. There's tons of pictures of this. You can find them on the web that actually show the Enceladus embedded in the E-ring. They're taken when Cassini was way up looking down, took a deep exposure, and you could just see the stuff building the E-ring in real time. It's really quite spectacular. This added Enceladus to a very exclusive club within our solar system of volcanically active worlds. But it's a different kind of volcanism. This is cryovolcanism. This is ice volcanoes. We're not bringing up molten lava from the inside like we are on the Earth, like we are on Io, the other volcanically active world in the solar system. There's one other volcanically active moon in addition to Io and Enceladus. It's Triton, which is the giant moon of Neptune. There, its geysers, its volcanism is liquid nitrogen, as we saw a little bit during our quick tour of the solar system. So just to put in perspective here, we've been looking at some pretty big places. Enceladus is tiny. This is a computer composite of Enceladus on a satellite map of Britain and Ireland. So this is a very small moon. It's only a couple hundred kilometers across. Now, the first question is, where is Enceladus getting its internal heat? It's a tiny body. It should be frozen all the way through. And the answer, again, is tidal heating. In this case, the tidal heating is coming from the fact that the moons are actually, some of the moons in Saturn are in these orbital resonances, and one of these is an orbital resonance with the somewhat larger moon, Dione. So that gives you this rhythmic tidal squeeze and release as it rolls around. It's kind of the kid on the swing effect again. So that gives you a source of internal heating. That internal heating is enough to melt subsurface water ice into liquid. That liquid makes its way through the cracks and bursts out. Because it's bursting out into a vacuum, some of those geysers are in fact ejecting the material at sufficient speed to escape, which then goes into feeding that E-ring. So again, once again, we're seeing the role of tidal heating. Now, there's some controversy right now about what the source of the tidal heating is on the inside, because if some calculations of the amount of tidal heating do not predict as much as you would need to explain the fountaining. And so some people are also adding the possibility that it's abetted by radioactive heating. And in fact, recent recalculations of Europa and Io say while tidal heating is very important, radioactive heating, the decay of radioactive elements, also plays a role in heating the interior. Much like on the Earth, the interior of the Earth is kept much warmer than it would be otherwise because of radioactive decay. So even relatively small bodies can have radioactive decay as a consequence. So what are the fountains? Well, here is the one of the favored models right now for this. It's called the cold geyser model. Now, geysers, when we see them on Earth, like in Yellowstone National Park, is very, very hot water heated by volcanic activity. Basically, there's a very large magma chamber underneath Yellowstone. Yellowstone is basically a supervolcano. It's a super caldera. You don't want it going off. It would probably cover the United States with badness if that happened. It did this many millions of years ago, but it hasn't done it since then. But there's still a lot of magma. The magma heats up the rock below. There's water from snow and other things going in there in the ponds. Builds up pressure, suddenly expands into steam. Water under pressure, expanding into low pressure atmosphere, suddenly bursts through a crack, and poof, you get Old Faithful geyser. The same basic principle is at work here. You get, in this particular model, it's primarily tidal heating coming up from below, the squeeze and release of the planet, the moon, in its resonance with, that's a planet without, in its resonance with Dione. Heats up the ice from the interior. It's basically a rock and ice world. Heats up the ices, and eventually you begin to get pressurized liquid. Remember that low pressure, as we saw on Mars, low pressure water tends to be either ice or vapor. But you have pressure here. The pressure is coming from the weight of all the ice on top of it, abetted by heat from below. You can actually achieve nearly atmospheric pressures, and liquid water a temperature kind of just hovering above freezing. Add a few impurities to this, like dissolved mineral salts, and you lower the freezing temperature. Just like on Earth, if you want to make, you know, old-fashioned ice cream makers where water with rock salt in it, the salts lower the freezing point below the freezing point of the water in the cream to make ice cream. So you can get a little bit of liquid if you just simply contaminate it with a little bit of mineral salts. So salty water will have a lower freezing temperature. 0 degrees Fahrenheit, by the way. You ever wonder why 0 Fahrenheit, 32 Fahrenheit for pure water? What's 0 Fahrenheit? That's when seawater freezes. So it lowers the temperature dramatically. You freeze it down, and you've got cracks and vents because this world's getting continually squeezed and released. The cracks form in the surface. Water under pressure suddenly sees a pathway out to vacuum, and foosh, it begins to spray out onto the surface. Of course, once it hits out there, you get water vapor, plus the stuff begins to flash into ice particles. So these ice particles then blast out off the surface. Some of the water vapor comes out as ice particles and snows down on the surface. The rest of it forms this general environment of fresh ices, which are constantly repaving and snowing down the surface. So you get extremely cold ice. I mean, this stuff is 77 degrees Kelvin, 77 degrees above absolute zero. Inside this hot pocket down underneath the ice, the water is, well, kind of like the water is today, coming out of a tap or a little bit colder. And then it works its way to the surface as a geyser. So that's how we can make a water geyser. But the first pictures were just, you see the geysers, you can see the material, you know it's water ice that makes up the ring. So there's sort of by association. But you'd really like to know what that water ice contains. And here's the beauty of the Cassini spacecraft. It wasn't a one-time flyby. It's orbiting the planet, and you can move it by firing engines, by making gravitational maneuvers against the other moons. And so in 2008, Cassini was redirected through a series of orbital maneuvers to skim just above the surface of Enceladus and fly right through the plumes, taking with it all of its particle sensors and everything else, taking pictures, and actually able to sample the ice plume. So in March of 2008, Cassini made this really wicked pass, whoom, right over the surface of the moon, flew through the fountains, plumes, was picking up ice particles, and the first thing it found is it was frozen salty water. So this is water which has got dissolved minerals in it. They also, the spectrograph on board, found traces of organic materials, and it found carbon-rich grains. Well, this got people really, really excited, because you have liquid water has to be there because you don't dissolve salts in solid ice. You have to have liquid to dissolve something. And this liquid is sufficiently steady state that it's dissolved minerals and it's dissolved complex organics. How complex is hard to say. All they really had was weight. They didn't have a detailed spectrum analysis. They couldn't look for amino acids or anything fancier than that. So pretty much all they found was organic compounds. They were heavy chains, aliphatic, probably aliphatic carbons for the most part, chain carbons. They found carbon-rich grains, which again they could tell by their weight and composition with the spectrograph. It was a gamma spectrometer. And they found that the water was not pure water. It was in fact salty water. It had dissolved mineral salts in it. This is extremely exciting. That's oceanic compositions. Those are things that are, you know, what is our ocean? Our ocean is salty water with dissolved organics and lots of carbon running around. Although in the case of the oceans, it's really dissolved carbon dioxide. So this is why people are really excited now about Enceladus. Here's actual evidence of at least the chemical signatures of the presence of liquid water. You would not get this from pure ices simply layering stuff down. Furthermore, the idea that these were geysers being heated from below is there are radiometers on board the spacecraft that can measure temperature. Now, these radiometers have kind of big, fat fields of view. They're meant to measure radiometers of big areas. But they flew just a few tens of kilometers over the surface, and the radiometers could actually distinguish between the terrain on either side of these deep tiger stripe cracks. Now, they knew from the big few radiometers that the tiger stripes seemed to be warmer in that region of the southern pole than the rest of the surface of cold Enceladus. But what they found was quite surprising. The average temperature on the surface of Enceladus in the white ice is 40, 50 degrees Kelvin above absolute zero. But right here at the cracks where we see the fountains emanating, the temperatures are as high as 180 degrees Kelvin. That's only minus 90 degrees Celsius in round numbers. Do that math right? Yeah, minus 90 degrees Celsius. That's warmer than places on the surface of Mars. And that's at the point of emergence, which is suggesting, in fact, that you've probably got the prerequisites for the heating of the liquid water below, deep below this ice surface. Now, we don't know how deep the ice is. There's no way to measure that. People have tried to model it. It's probably a few kilometers. So we have some of the interesting prerequisites for life. We have a source of heat, in this case tidal heating, probably abetted by a bit of radioactive decay on the surface inside the interior of Enceladus. We have liquid water. We have evidence of liquid water in various ways because the water's been in a liquid phase in order to do the dissolving of mineral salts and carbon grains and things like that. We have organics, a source of carbon. We have a lot of the pieces that we need that we think on Earth are the prerequisites for life. So this now becomes the second place in our solar system where we might go looking for life. Now, we only have, again, the evidence we've been able to gather by repurposing Cassini. This was not in the original mission. This was a complete surprise. It just knocked everyone off their feet when the fountains were seen. It's one of the most spectacular discoveries of the spacecraft. By being able to point the spacecraft, change its orbit, it was not designed to do that kind of work. So the engineers and scientists at JPL deserve a lot of credit for being able to do that. We actually now have probably added a second world, which is a possible place to look for life, which has some of those requirements that we think existed on the early Earth. Liquid water, a source of energy, a source of carbon. So it's a really exciting possibility, but it's an exciting possibility for the future. This is now as much as we know about Enceladus. It's a very exciting place. Questions about Enceladus before we go on. The second world of interest to us around Saturn, and in fact was really one of the main thrusts of the Cassini mission, is the giant moon Titan. Titan is the only moon in the entire solar system that has a heavy atmosphere. In fact, it has any kind of substantial atmosphere at all. It's a pretty big moon. It's about 2,500 kilometers in radius, about 5,000 kilometers across. It's the second biggest moon in the solar system after Ganymede. Its density is about 1.9 grams per cc. That's denser than water, which is 1 gram per cc, but not as dense as rock, which is around 3 grams per cc. So that's telling you that Titan is one of these rocky, icy composites, probably a rocky core with an icy mantle on top of it. It's really cold out in Saturn. Saturn is about 10 astronomical units from the Sun. That means the sunlight received at Saturn is 1%, 10 squared, of what it is on the Earth. So this is a very, very cold place. So that means even an object which is relatively undermassive, doesn't have a lot of gravity, it's the cold that helps it retain an atmosphere. So the fact that it's a big moon in a cold place is how it can retain its atmosphere. And the atmosphere is nitrogen and methane. But what's really surprising is how substantial the atmosphere here is. This picture is fuzzy because we're looking through clouds of methane crystals, among other things, as well as a very high altitude haze of complex organics, basically a photochemical smog. So what we find in this atmosphere is it's made up mostly of nitrogen, N2, just like on the Earth, plus methane. Actually, it's much more rich in nitrogen than the Earth. It's nitrogen and methane. This is a heavy atmosphere. The pressure is high enough that you can actually have methane go into a three-phase diagram, and methane can actually be liquid and stable on the surface of Titan. So we're not going to find water ice. It's still too cold for water ice. But you could find liquid methane. And you may remember back when we talked about the requirements for life last week, one of the requirements for life is a solvent, a liquid solvent for chemistry to occur into. We always focus on water because water's got great properties and water's what we use. But there were other liquid solvents, liquid ammonia, liquid ethane, and liquid methane. And in fact, both methane and ethane can be liquid phase on the surface of Titan. So here's a picture we've seen before. This is our escape speed versus temperature plot for the solar system. Earth and Venus up here, Mars down here, the lines of hydrogen, helium, methane, water vapor, nitrogen and carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide. Titan, if Titan was in the inner solar system, it'd be a dead airless place. Gravity would be way too small to hold on to anything. It's only slightly more massive than our moon. But because Titan's out here at the outer part of the solar system, 80, 90 degrees Kelvin in its upper atmosphere, it's able to hold on to methane, water vapor. The problem with water vapor is water vapor freezes immediately into ice, so it's no longer in the atmosphere. It literally snows out. Nitrogen and carbon dioxide, but carbon dioxide freezes and snows out. So the only of these compounds here that can remain in gas at 90 degrees Kelvin are methane and nitrogen. Everything else pretty much rains out as a snow. Carbon monoxide is really a minority compound. And sure enough, that's exactly what we see. Titan has a very, very dense nitrogen and methane atmosphere. It's about 90 to 97% nitrogen with another 1.6% of methane. We also find argon and complex hydrocarbons like ethane. In carbon chain molecules, methane and then ethane. Ethane is the next one up. It's two carbons with six hydrogens around it. It's a really cold place. The basic temperature in the atmosphere is 94 degrees Kelvin. That's minus 290 degrees Fahrenheit. Water's totally solid. Carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, solid. The atmospheric pressure on the surface of Titan is 1.6 Earth atmospheres. It's even heavier in terms of atmospheric pressure than on the Earth. This is a big, heavy atmosphere. This brown color, this is planet Saturn. Titan's passing between the Cassini spacecraft and Saturn. You can see the shadow of the ring up here is the dark line here. That's not a flaw in the picture. And you see Titan looks kind of like a icky red-brown billiard ball. That's smog. Any of you have ever gone to a really big city in the summertime? I went to school in Los Angeles in the 1970s. I know that color. That's called smog alert day. This is basically photochemical smog. This is photons, UV photons from the from the sun, interacting with nitrogen and, of course, other goodies, some oxygen, water vapor in the upper atmosphere, making nitric oxides, NOXs, really awful stuff. Corrodes your lungs, turns the sky brown, and that's what Titan is. Titan is, the upper atmosphere of Titan is the smog moon. So you get this photochemical smog. A detailed analysis of this, based on mostly Cassini as well as work from the ground, has shown in addition to this photochemical nitrate smog, some of the other compounds in there are actually complex organics, photochemical organics. There are a class of compounds which is basically hydrocarbon crud known as tholins. The reason why you're getting hydrocarbon crud is you're in the outer solar system. You're in the realm of reducing chemistry. Methane is going to be an important gas, and there's your carbon, which again, when you get sort of gas phase chemistry going on, you can actually build some heavy, nasty stuff. And then below that are actual clouds, white frozen crystal clouds of methane and ethane. The surface is relatively young. We actually have, with infrared cameras, you can peer through the methane clouds. There are strong bands in methane that cause absorption, but you can look between those bands, and you see that the surface is actually geologically fairly young. There's highlands, there's rugged terrain, there's methane mud flats, which are actually pretty flat. They're almost featureless. There's very, very few craters on the surface of Titan. This is a place with active weather, and there's active weathering. There's a couple craters, they're there. There's even some signs of possibly ancient cryovolcanism. There's some suggestive-looking volcanic cone structures, but people are still arguing what kind of volcanism they might be. But what's really spectacular is these dendritic features, these branching features, which are drainage flows. From the highlands down to these low mud flats, what you're seeing is actual liquid flows, but the liquid that's flowing is methane, liquid methane, into immense liquid methane lakes. Now, the images through the clouds are kind of tricky. Actually, you see this one of the bright clouds there, up there, sort of getting between you and the ground. In addition, the Cassini spacecraft carries a cloud-penetrating imaging radar system. So it's actually able to image through the clouds and actually do radar mapping of the surface, only in every one brief pass. Slowly but surely, we're building up a pretty complete view of the surface of Titan. But not only imaging, the Cassini spacecraft carried a lander on board of it called the Huygens lander. It's named for Christian Huygens. He was a Dutch astronomer who in the late 17th century discovered the moon Titan with an early post-Galilean telescope. So the European Space Agency built the Huygens probe, which was released from the Cassini spacecraft on Christmas Day in 2004, made a brief journey across an orbit, and on the 15th of January 2005, Titan was added to that list of worlds, including the Moon, Venus, Mars, and one asteroid so far that have actually had human presence, if robotic, on their surface. A parachute opened up, and it proceeded to then make about a 2.5-hour parachute descent through the atmosphere of Titan, taking pictures and sampling with chemical probes all the way down the line, eventually striking the ground. Now, at this point, there was a lot of wonder going on in 2005 as to what was going to happen when the Huygens probe hit down. What if it splashed into a methane lake? It was actually designed to be able to float for a short amount of time. In fact, what it did was it actually squelched down into a methane mudflat. When it squelched down, the heat from the spacecraft caused the methane liquid to flash into a vapor, and there was a sudden spike in the methane content, and then fell off pretty quickly. So that was the first sign. It pretty much just squelched down into the mud. And then it lasted for 2 hours on the surface, intense cold. It wasn't designed to last very long. It lasted long enough until finally the distance between the Cassini spacecraft, which was its radio relay, and the ground antennas on Huygens got so far apart that they broke radio contact. Basically, the spacecraft came around, and the space probe was on the other side of Titan from the Cassini. By the time Cassini and the other ground stations on Earth came back online, the cold had finally gotten to it and the Huygens probe had shut off. But that wasn't before it sent us pictures from the ground on Titan. So this is probably the most alien world that humans have ever reached. This is a world where the surface temperature is 290 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, where methane is water equivalent. It's a liquid form. You're looking at a mud flat in which a mud flat on the Earth is grains of sand, silicate sand, suffused and saturated with water. On Titan, These are grains of water ice, is the sand of Titan, suffused with liquid methane and liquid ethane, but mostly liquid methane. Now, the black and white view, these boulders, those aren't rocks. Those are probably ice balls. Those are ice rocks. Ice, water ice, at 290 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, is basically as hard as rock. So water ice is the rock of Titan, is a way to think about the rock and the sand. So what you're seeing is a methane mud flat. There's distant mountains you can see there. These were the few pictures which were beamed back before the spacecraft succumbed to the cold. They took it in multiple filters. If you put those images together, this is what you would see if you were actually an astronaut standing on the surface of Titan. It's a very hazy place. It looks like a really, you know, the worst smoggy day from hell in Los Angeles in the late September during a fire. I've been through that before. Sort of a yellow-orange haze everywhere, kind of like an orangish sunset, rocks and plains stretching out as far as the eye can see. It's probably, as I said, it's probably the most ancient place, the most alien place we've ever been, yet we've been there. This is a billion kilometers from Earth. We managed to send a spacecraft through 10 years of space, a billion kilometers, landed a box about this big around on the surface and sent pictures back from the surface. We live in a really wonderful time. This is a look down. This is now using radar imaging down through the surface. What we find is, in fact, Titan's plains have vast dune fields. We find that these dunes are actually made of water ice. There's probably a little bit of hydrocarbons in here as well. Gives it some of that dark color. So it's probably not perfectly water ice. Some of those hydrocarbons made by photochemistry up in the atmosphere rain down and mix in with the water ice. But you see the effect of wind. So there are aeolian processes. There are processes in which wind is sculpting terrain. And that's another explanation for you're seeing a very active weather. That's why there's so few craters on the surface here. The other interesting thing about Titan is the role of methane. I've already alluded to it. Methane is to Titan what water is to the Earth. That's a way to think about it. Methane is Titan's water. It plays exactly the same role in weather that water plays here on the Earth. This means that methane exists in all three phases: liquid, solid, and gas. How does this work? Well, in the atmosphere, as you go up in atmosphere, the temperature begins to rise a little bit. Of course, it's very cold on the surface down here, about 90 Kelvin or so. It rises up into a layer where you get condensation, where you suddenly get a temperature inversion, absorption of sunlight in here. That absorption of sunlight causes a rapid heating, and you get up temperatures of about 130 degrees Kelvin. You start getting the formations of that photochemical haze. You form clouds. You form that sort of smogish and other condensates. This is the haze layer. It's up about 60 to 80 kilometers above. At intermediate layers, you actually get clouds, which are now made of methane and nitrogen. Those clouds have actually been observed to make rain, or in very cold places near the poles, methane snow. This flows down and folds down out into the lowlands, flows down, carving these channels, filling these lakes. Impacts of meteors that make it through the atmosphere will actually melt the surface and release water vapor and ammonia and other compounds into the atmosphere, so it's a way of getting some more material up there. It's even speculated, although we see things that look like volcanoes, if there is sufficient internal heat to have a kind of cryovolcanism. Now we're not talking about molten magma, molten rock, but we're talking about things like liquid ethane flashing into gas and methane and maybe even some water vapor below. So water, methane, and ethane kind of become... liquid water is like the magma of Titan. Also would go into a cycle of making methane. So we have a methane cycle on Titan that's like the water cycle of weather on the Earth. So this is really crazy. You get these methane mud flats, which are these water ice grains and liquid methane, and we get towards the poles. You get deep lowlands. We get a lot of precipitation going on down there. It's seasonal precipitation that actually produces sufficient standing water to actually make liquid methane. Now, how would you tell a liquid from just simply a flatlands? And the way you can tell is radar signals bounce very differently off the surface of a smooth liquid than they do off of pebbles and things like that, which tend to scatter the radar in all the directions. So what you get from a liquid is a very clean return. And in a radar map, that looks dark. And so there was some expectation. Some people expected Titan to have vast methane-ethane oceans. That didn't turn out to be the case. A lot of the places are much more specular, more shiny to the radar. That's why it's the idea of these methane mudflats. But then Titan, again, Titan only could just look at the planet in strips. As Cassini flew past Titan, it made very quick passes, and so you just build up stripe by stripe. And eventually, the passage of the spacecraft passed over the southern and northern poles, and it was when it passed through the poles, they found this. This is a lake of methane. It is bigger than Lake Superior on the Earth. Again, Titan is probably one of the most alien places we have ever sent things. This has been colorized a bit. What the color codes as dark is smooth, strong radar return versus specular radar return, bouncing off of bricks, bouncing off of boulders. What can you say? There's shorelines. There's drainage channels flowing down into this lake of methane. There are islands within a lake of methane. So imagine Lake Superior on the Earth. It's not too different in size from this, but not filled with water. It's filled with liquid methane. Why is this so interesting? Other than just simply the utter coolness factor of seeing a world with liquid methane lakes in it, and liquid methane rivers that rains liquid methane from methane clouds or even has methane snow, where water ice is sand, is the conditions on this planet are like a cold analogy of the prebiotic Earth. And that's why the interest in Titan is so important. This is the only other example of an atmosphere we have with really, really active weather. Venus is blasted dry. It's a runaway greenhouse effect. It's basically a train wreck of an atmosphere. It tells us what atmospheres are going to look like in the distant future of the Earth, but it doesn't tell us anything about prebiotic atmospheres. What would the original atmosphere of the Earth look like? Mars is a dead atmosphere that's mostly been lost. Its water vapor's frozen out. Its outer levels have been stripped off when the magnetic field collapsed. Titan is an intact primordial atmosphere with active weather. That's why it fascinates us so much. It's got abundant hydrocarbons. It's got complex organics everywhere. It's got raw materials for life. But what it doesn't have is a really good source of heat and liquid water. The atmosphere supports a cycle, a methane cycle, like a water cycle. So it could be a laboratory for the kind of prebiotic chemistry that went on the Earth, but a very low temperature version of that. And so it's really becoming now another focus of study in the solar system. It's got an atmosphere. Here's a concept. You want to travel around Titan, but Titan's got weather and you can't put a lander down. So here's one of the more really gutsy proposals. You send down a lander, and instead of landing, or lands, also deploys a balloon so it can float on the methane nitrogen winds of Titan and float over the terrain, descend down to places to make samples, and then pick itself back up again and fly around. After all I got to do is have something to keep the gases cold. So it's not as crazy as it looks. There's a concept that's currently going on that if we could get the money to launch it in about 2020, 2021, would probably make it to Titan and actually be deployed during the 2030s. The question is whether we have any will to do this. It's going to be expensive. This is a multi-billion euro, multi-billion dollar, multi-billion yuan. I don't know which currency or who's going to do this. But it could be done. This is all current technology. It's entirely doable. So the goal is to try to go to these places because they're so different from what we have on the Earth, but they have complex chemistry. They have sources of heat. They have a liquid solvent. Okay, it's methane instead of water. But they have some of the prerequisites for life just in a very alien way. And so it's another world that fascinates us in the search for life. Maybe we're wrong about life. Maybe there are some complex chemistry that can go on in the extreme cold. It's the extreme cold that's kind of the problem. It's not going to be proteins and amino acids, probably. It's going to be something different if it's there at all. We just don't know. This is so unexpected and so alien, it just excites the imagination to think what might be underneath the clouds of Titan. Any questions? Okay, I will see you all tomorrow.